So this session that we decided on would be on talk about the new atheism, which we subtitled Faith Without Reason. I can't quite remember when we got to that, but I'm sure it's a good title. There we are. So that's dear Richard Dawkins, Professor Richard Dawkins, a distinguished professor of biology at Oxford. Very good. I'm sure in his own sphere. Actually, if you're good, you're good in your own sphere, it doesn't mean, again, that you're a genius or infallible, or that you make a contribution here. It's like Stephen Hawking, who we talked about. He was kind of, at this time, and Stephen Hawking, God bless him, who was rightly regarded by the public with great sympathy because he coped with terrible disabilities and so forth. But again, a lot of this is to do with media hype again. That so if you're an academic domain and you make a certain contribution in your academic domain, you are not the most knowledgeable person, even in your own academic domain. You make mistakes in your own academic domain. But this is, when people like Stephen Hawking produced books, this was an utter genius who knew about the whole cosmos and he'd given us a book. Again, this is a fairy story generated by the media. If you're a good academic in your own domain, you specialise and you subspecialise and you subspecialise, and you make a contribution to that tiny bit. Of course, you have to know something general about the rest. So that's what Stephen Hawking, God bless him, did, wrote general books. But he only did, and of course he had to, specialise in a certain little area, that was black holes, and some of his theories there. Other distinguished scientists corrected later to do with can information, can data escape from black hole? He thought not, and other people did experiments showing that it could. So, even a very, even Einstein got all sorts of things wrong. Einstein thought that quantum mechanics didn't make sense and quantum mechanics is the same. So, again, this is part of seeing through the media hype of any of these things. The media hype is that these people are utter geniuses. They know everything about everything. But the truth is, of course, in the modern specialized world, people know less and less and less. I mean, that's inevitable. One of the great physicists in the 20th century, Erwin Schrödinger, said that the specialist is a barbarian. And that's true because people specialize and specialize and specialize. And so they don't really know about anything outside the laboratory. Anyway, that's kind of,
thank you.
It's important, but that's actually part of the topic. The new atheism was a kind of another media product. And when we look at media products, we have to use our reason to understand what's going on. And I thought when we had to do something on this, I kind of thought to myself, I didn't take a great interest in new atheism when it was going on, but I thought to myself, I haven't really heard about it much for a while. And so I checked this out on the internet and I came up with two rather interesting articles, one published in 2021 and one published in 2022. One is by a chap called Stephen Morris, and it was entitled, Why is Atheism No Longer Cool? And in this one in 2022 was on a similar theme by Sebastian Milbank, and he wrote an article, The Strange Afterlife of New Atheism. And both these authors bring our attention to what I kind of sensed had happened, was the fact that the new atheism movement around in the media in the early 2000s is now passé, it's passed. The media have now moved on. It's now no longer a new movement. It's a fad that passed. And of course the names here, the big names were the Oxford biologist Richard Dawkins and controversialists, you might call them, like Sam Harris or Christopher Hitchens here. The only philosopher who occasionally liked to chip in supportively to some of this was the American Daniel Dennett. Daniel Dennett is a philosopher who writes on the philosophy of mind, and I wouldn't be the only person who knows from that philosophy a lot of philosophers, not Catholics or Christians or anything, but have lots of problems with Daniel Dennett's philosophy is philosophical writing on the philosophy of mind. But he was the only one that occasionally chipped in. It seemed like the spirit of this kind of movement was also there in the popular books of the late physicist Stephen Hawking, whose heroic struggle with disability rightly won admiration. And then even towards the end of the period, the popular television programs of Professor Brian Cox. He didn't actually attack religion at all, but it seemed that was the kind of media package around the time. This is a picture of course, Christopher Hitchens, who dies. Now, a lot of people said that actually Christopher Hitchens, they enjoyed, in a sense, when he died, a lot of it died, because he was very entertaining. He was an entertaining opponent. Alistair McGrath, who was an Anglican theologian at Oxford, who often, he had a scientific background, having been an agnostic himself, would often engage some of these people in debate. And he said he always enjoyed Christopher Hitchens because he was entertaining and fun. But, you know, Richard Dawkins wasn't. And the thing is that none of these people were philosophers, and the more entertaining ones were Sam Harris and people. These were what you call interlopers. They're not academics at all. They sort of leap around from this and that and grab this and that idea. God bless him. Christopher Hitchens, of course, he died. His brother, Peter Hitchens, became an evangelical Christian, and I believe Peter Hitchens' son, who did a doctorate at Oxford, became a Catholic when he was doing a doctorate at Oxford, Peter Hitchens. But, I mean, actually, God bless him, when you realise somebody's life story, I did read at the time something about the late, God bless him, Christopher Hitchens, and his brother, their anti-religious attitudes. I mean, you can hardly blame them when you read their life story. They were sons, their mother had an adulterous affair with an Anglican clergyman when they were boys, left the father, and the mother and the man friend went off to Athens and both committed suicide. So, you know, and that's your kind of experience of religion, you know, goodness me, have mercy on them. But this media hype works by promoting the idea that something is new, something has just been discovered for the man on the street by the really clever people in the universities, you know. There's some new progress that ordinary people need to know about through the television. This is the kind of media promotion of this sort of thing. With this movement now past, we have another unsurprising case of smoke and mirrors by which most popular media is characterised. So it's a package, it's a media thing, it's a hype thing. Comes and goes. And they pass, these things pass. And actually, we have here the old swing that we've been talking about through the day, the swing between scientism, as John Paul II would describe it, the hard facts of materiality, and subjectivism on the other. So this ding-dong battle between the Enlightenment thing and then the subjectivism on the other, the postmodern. So here I've got two pictures here. You hurt my feelings. There's science. So the new atheism was meant to be all about this, you know, the hard scientific facts of reality. And evidently in Milbank, in his article on this, it says what's happened as part of the new atheism going out of fashion is that another wave of postmodernism stuff has taken its place. And this is all the we don't want any of that reason stuff, we just want feelings and emotions and our cause and our championing and our cause and all of this harsh reason rationality stuff. So we just have here more of this kind of slide from one extreme to the other. This caricature of rationality and reason in terms of Enlightenment thing reason, so it's only physical science is reason, and the reaction to that that you see in terms of postmodernism. And what we've got in the public domain, why, according to these writers I found, why, New Atheism went out was because it was all about science is the bee's knees, that's the only counter reality. And now we've slid away from that. into another subjective phase where we don't have any reason, we just have these passionate causes, and if anybody disagrees with us, we just chuck them out of the university. So that's what we've slid, again, like the boat rocking to and fro. We've just gone from one, we've slid from one end of the deck to the other. I remember I used to say to our philosophy students at Maryville when the new atheism was on, from what I dipped in to have a look at it, what was going on, I used to say to them at the time, I said new atheism was actually a disgrace to serious philosophical atheism, because none of the people involved in it were really serious. In a previous generation, our parents' generation, when I was young, occasionally on Radio 3, the third programme, and BBC Two, when it got going, you'd have these interviews or things, highbrow things from Bertrand Russell or A.J. Eyre or Anthony Flew, these atheists and people like that. But of course, that was too highbrow to be sort of like hyped up in the media. But these at least were serious atheists who knew the classical arguments in philosophy, for God's existence, and they would argue one way or the other, like that. But in the new atheism, you didn't have any of that. It wasn't really about arguing about God's existence against the great classical arguments of God's existence at all. An earlier generation, as I say, would have seen this. Most of the new atheists were totally ignorant of philosophy, and the most effective and perhaps entertaining ones were not academics at all, like Hitchens and Harris. Milbank, in his article, says that what has replaced new atheism is the woke subjectivism that we spoke of before, the advocating, sometimes violent and intimidating, of various causes which people passionately feel. We don't want this talk of scientific objectivity here. So what we have here is another popular manifestation of the swing, the oscillation in Western culture between scientific objectivity is all we need, on the one hand, enlightenment, to the inevitable reaction to it in subjectivist feeling causes on the other. This pattern we can see in the swing from the 18th century Enlightenment to the reaction in Romanticism even, and in the various philosophies and cultural movements that followed, battling it out in the 19th and the 20th century. The Catholic vision of the harmony between faith and reason, in a sense, is lost sight of in this swing to and fro. The authors of the two articles I mentioned usefully bring out what characterised this new atheism wave. It was not a serious discussion of the classical philosophical arguments of God's existence and nature. Thinkers trained in science, philosophy and theology, like Oxford, Alistair McGrath, Anglican theologian, would say how disappointing debates were with these folk, that people like McGrath agreed to engage in, because of this lack of awareness of what the arguments really are and how to argue about them. That people like Dawkins or something, he can be very good or skilled in his area, he's not infallible, but he has no training in anything else. So he doesn't know when he's debating something, when he's being totally irrelevant. Again, this is a sort of a media hype thing, where you say, well, here's this really clever bloke, he's a professor in Oxford, he's the world's leading expert on dentistry, so let's go and interview him on Egyptology, because he must know everything. I mean, it's just a load of nonsense, but why then go and talk to a biologist about theology, or somebody who absolutely knows nothing about it, knows nothing about philosophy? This is true because it cuts both ways. Some years ago, I was asked to contribute to a collection of essays in a book by a very interesting chap called Roy Varghese. Roy Varghese had edited several books, and I remember having a long phone conversation with me about this project, and I did something for it. This was only 20 years ago. People used to talk on the phone. And Roy Varghese had edited a book in the late 1990s where he had got Christians who were Nobel Prize winners in science to contribute to a book. And that's a wonderful book, a wonderful apologetic book, a witness to these distinguished scientists in those various fields around the world who were also practicing Christians. Wonderful, apologetic value to show people in general public, yes, here are people, fantastic scientists and serious Christians. But he actually said to me on the phone, the thing was, because he had a philosophical training, he said, well, the thing was, he said, really though, when you get them talking about other things apart from science, so like how science fits in with the whole view of reality and their Christian worldview, he said, actually, a lot of them, it's not pretty good. He says, it's a bit rubbishy. He said, although it was wonderful to see this as a witness, they weren't very good at articulating how science, and these were believers. So it cuts both ways. You can be an expert in your scientific field, but when it comes even to talking about the significance of your science within the whole worldview and this and that, that's not your training. People who are very good in the area of philosophy or philosophy of science usually are people who have had a scientific training and then also have gone into philosophy. But again, this is the thing that Einstein himself said to people who were writing on the philosophy of science, studying the philosophy of science. He said, when you're investigating the philosophy of science, he said, don't listen to what scientists say about what they do, look at what they actually do, their practice. Because they may not be good at it. It's a bit like somebody who could be brilliant at woodwork. But it's one thing to be brilliant at woodwork, to be a wonderful carpenter. It's another thing to be a carpenter who can write a book on carpentry. There are some people who can, and there are some people who cannot. They can't articulate it. You say, well, just look what I do, and they'll say a few things as they do it, and they'll tell you, but that's not their gift. And so somebody can be a brilliant scientist. When you ask them to talk about the way that science, what's the philosophy of science, how does knowledge enter into science, how does science relate to the rest of reality, and these sort of things, they can't articulate it, and that's fine, because that's not their area. They're not geniuses in everything. And as I say, that book by Ward Vicasey, wonderful witness that people who are very distinguished scientists are also deeply Christian, but still they said the weakness of the book is they couldn't articulate that. And so, it goes both ways. So when we look at this new atheism, what did they really do in it? They didn't really enter into that great debate or try to question the great arguments for God's existence, the arguments from, the fact that the world doesn't explain itself, so it requires an ultimate cause, it was God. They didn't get into those philosophical debates, really. They weren't trained to do so, but rather, as these writers of these two articles point out, what they did, the new atheism, was two things. It was an attack that they attacked Christianity, and again, they just assumed that Christianity is one thing. So you may take, what you knew about your Methodist Christianity and say that's the whole of Christianity. They attacked it on the basis of A, this view that science explains everything, so we don't need religion, very popular one, and B, as these couple of writers said, because of 9/11, we can see that religions are morally dangerous. So these are the two-pronged attack that they made on religion. And as I say, these are exactly the same old themes that we see in 18th century writers, people like Hume and Diderot and Voltaire. They were attacking religion just in that way. Science has replaced it, and look at the history of Christianity and all the moral failures of Christians, and doesn't work, it's no good. It's a bad thing, Christianity. So, Diderot wrote this book. My son Ben was having to look at it in French literature, writing there in the 18th century about story about the life of a nun who has this terrible life in the convent. It's a novel he writes, to see how bad they really are. These nuns are really bad and they're cruel and this poor woman's persecuted and everything, So, okay. There are always bad apples, but the idea is therefore all nuns are all cruel, all corrupted, all forced into it. That's the implication of the novel, that they're all wasting their time or or abused or something like that. So it's the same old things. So I think we can best begin, if we're going to look at New Atheism, what their attacks were. Again, it's not a very long session because we've got things to do. But we can best begin to look at least at these two areas which have long been subjects discussed in Catholic apologetics. So Catholic faith and science. And the last time I was here, we actually had a kind of mini course on Catholic faith and science. Within the space that's left this evening, I can't hope to do that. But first of all, I mentioned the word scientism before. And that's the phrase that St. John Paul II uses in his great encyclical on faith and reason, scientism. And what we mean by scientism, again, it's not science itself, but a certain philosophy of science. So it's not what the scientist does, it's not what Richard Dawkins does when he's doing the good work he may do in experiments in biology, good or bad as that may be within his own domain, but it's what he says about science in general and its place and the nature of it and what it does and its scope and limits. And that then is a philosophy of science. It's not the science itself, it's a philosophy of it. So scientism is a philosophy of science which is a philosophy where you say, well, science tells you that everything about reality, so we don't need, there's no room for any other knowledge. There's no room for theology, there's no room for anything else, no room for philosophy or anything like that. So that's scientism, and that's not science itself, but a take on science. But I think we can't do all this evening, but when you start to tackle this whole area of the popular image of science versus religion, which should be totally taken apart, because it there are three areas to look at, and I can only flag these up this evening because we can't go into them. First of all, the way that the Catholic faith, the Catholic tradition, in our Catholic faith, we know the truths of God's revelation through Holy Scripture, through sacred tradition, and through the magisterium of the Church, guided by the Holy Spirit. That's how we know our Catholic truths of faith. And on that basis, we approach sacred scripture. In that way, you see the Catholic approach to certain issues that people bring up that impact the whole discussion of science and religion. That's the Catholic view. It's not the fundamentalist Christian view. It's not the liberal Christian view. So again, when the New Atheists are saying, oh, now the Christian view, or that's totally naive. What I'm on about here, for example, is Genesis. So the Catholic way of approaching Genesis, typically, of course, this is all about, oh, well, how does Genesis fit with the scientific accounts? And the Catholic tradition, which follows the way that St. Augustine went on this, see it in St. Thomas too, that the text, the stories in Genesis, they are divinely revealed truths, but as the Catechism says, they're expressed sometimes in symbolic form. So we don't think that when we read Genesis, we are having information that tells us, making scientific claims, that at one time snakes all went around on the end of their tails, that they stood upright. That's not what Genesis is telling us. So in a way, we can, the fathers of the church could say things like St. Clement of Alexandria, St. Augustine, and so forth, would say the days represent vast periods. So the Catholic approach through scripture, tradition, and magisterium, right from the time of the fathers, has been to see there are divinely revealed truths in Genesis, that God created the world, he created for no other purpose than out of love, all was good in the world, our first parents were in a state of grace, that at the temptation of Satan our first parents fell, and so forth. Those are divinely revealed truths. They are truths taught by the infallible magisterium of the Church. So the Church, and of course the Church reads Genesis also in the light of the whole of Scripture, in the light of St. Paul in Romans and so forth. So there's a proper approach to Genesis, which is not actual literalism, but it's not going to the other extreme of, oh, you can interpret anything you like, because thank God we have the magisterium, we have the dogmas of the church to say, no, in Genesis we're taught these truths, these dogmas, but they may be taught in a symbolic, otherwise it's symbolic. As St. Thomas says, the text of Genesis was written for the ruddy populace, it was written for primitive people. St. Thomas says that himself. So there actually was an early church heresy that the fathers rejected that was based on a literalist, fundamentalist reading of Genesis, because in Genesis it says God walked in the garden in the evening. So there was a small heretical group around in the 3rd century that said, well, the divinity has, not talking about the incarnation when our Lord has a human body, but the divinity, God, the Godhead has a body, was like a Superman. So because it says God walked in the garden, so God has arms and legs. And the fathers of the church said, well, that's nonsense, that's not the God, is a pure spirit. And even St. Jerome said, it's a stultissima heresy, a stupid heresy. So Genesis is not just a literal account. It uses symbolic figurative language, but through it, divine revealed truths are taught, and we can know that as Catholics because the magisterium has defined dogmas of what Genesis teaches us. If you're not a Catholic, you've got the trouble of, I was in a debate with somebody once years ago, if you don't accept everything as being literal as Genesis, then where do you stop? Mm-hmm. So if you don't accept that God had legs walking in the garden, then where do you stop? Well, of course, then you can swing completely to the other extreme, like liberal Anglicans, and say, well, even God's just a symbol for being nice to people. So thank God we have the scripture, tradition, and magisterium as the way of knowing the divine revealed truths. And the magisterium and the tradition of the church helps us to interpret Genesis and see what are the divine revealed truths in Genesis, but understand their expressed and figurative language. So that, you know, you've got to do all that when you talk about it, because that will be one thing that people go on about science and religion. Then a second area is history. It's the history of science and the Catholic faith. Of course, there are great scholars like Stanley Yackey who wrote on this, but there are many scholars writing. And the best way in apologetics, I think, in any area of apologetics, is to use the most up-to-date historical research and knowledge of the highest academic quality on the history of Christianity and science, published by Catholics, non-Catholics, Christians alike. And if you study that history of science at the state of the art where we are today, serious academics, you'll have a very, very, very different idea than the popular one that could be peddled by new theism, atheism, of the relationship between Catholicism and science. And that is that what you come away, if you study all that, is that modern science owes massively to Christianity. It's a child of Christianity in many ways. It begins in ancient Greece, but there are key things that are added in the Christian Middle Ages, not least the whole invention of the university. And scholars will tell you, the university is a unique phenomenon that never happened in other high civilizations. The university, it was a medieval Christian idea. And phenomenon, and then it spread to the rest of the world and so forth. And in the university, in the Middle Ages, it's where you see Aristotle is this great figure in the history of science. He makes such a contribution to the ancient Greece. But many of his theories were corrected and modified even during the Middle Ages. And in the Middle Ages, you start to have experiment, which is a key thing in science. There's observation in Aristotle, but not really experiment. And what is added in the Christian Middle Ages is experiment. You've got to do experiments. There can be many theories to account for this data, but you have to do experiments to see which theory has the most evidence for it. I'm only summarizing all this. So that is something that is very key. If you look at that, research, you'll understand that rather than being opposed to Christianity, a science in its modern form, in many ways that's what grows and develops through the Middle Ages because of that Christian matrix and that Christian world. Of course, science as it develops and gets speeds up more and more and more. It speeds up because it's a community activity. You need more technology. You've got to build a machine to help you do a certain experiment, and you need the technicians and the materials to build that little piece of apparatus, and that takes a long time, and you need the collaboration. So I mean, there are phases, and it develops, and it tends to accelerate as you get into the 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th centuries. But it's still crucial, the Middle Ages, for setting the course, and that's what modern scholarship shows us. And then finally, the third area, the science and religion thing, you have to look at the way philosophy of science really affects the discussion. So philosophy of science, good philosophy of science, is an area of philosophy. So most people who are really good in philosophy of science are people who have a really good scientific background training, but then a training in philosophy. So in the philosophy of science, all sorts of things come in. So like the theory of knowledge, like, you know, the sort of things we were looking at, how we get to know the truth this morning. Then metaphysics, what's the nature of reality, and all those things enter into philosophy of science. And also philosophy of science involves studying scientific methodology, scientific reasoning, and so forth. And none of that just says, oh well, science tells you everything about reality. Science just does what it does in certain areas of life. I mean, for example, as an Oxford philosopher who's not at all a Catholic or anything, recently wrote Timothy Williamson against people who sort of think, oh well, physics tells us everything on chemistry. Well, I said, what about history? You know, history also tells us all sorts of things. It's a reasonable, rational debate, you know, tending to the evidence and all this, we're kind of making judgments. And when we're studying the history of Napoleon or whatever, the physics comes in because there's got to be the atoms going around on the field of the Battle of Waterloo. The biology comes in, well, there's grass growing, you know, and everything. But that doesn't tell us about the Battle of Waterloo. We have to use the methods of the historical research and being intelligent and reasonable and come to judgments about what Napoleon's motives were and then what happened that went wrong and the military action. And that leads you off into study of the gunpowder used at the time and also the Allied disciplines. But that's the area of the historian. That's not, you don't understand the back of the water just by studying physics or chemistry. So that's just one example of an area of further human research and investigation that's not covered by the physical sciences. And we can go on there into areas of philosophy like metaphysics and all these things that are other areas of human knowledge. The physical sciences are one area of human knowledge, but not the whole story. Philosophy of science helps you to understand that. So those are three areas that really, as I say, I'm only flagging them up here. There's a little bit more, yes, that we could say here, but I did on the history. So this is kind of what I was saying about Aristotle is a key person in the history of science. Here's just a picture of a medieval university, the student sitting there, the lecturer. The scholars reckon this is Albert of Saxony, who was a Dominican. He looks like he has a turban on, but it's actually a kind of a head thing that they wore when it was cold. And here he's probably he's giving a commentary on a book by Aristotle. But what happened was Aristotle does, and he continues, a lot of philosophers of science would say Aristotelian thought still plays a role in science. Of course, the metaphysics underlying it does. But in a way, what Aristotle presents is a kind of research program, and then people sort of disagreed and agreed with bits of Aristotle and modified him over the centuries. And you see Aquinas in some of his commentaries on Aristotle's books on physics. Aquinas will say, well, that doesn't work actually, Aristotle, because if you think about this, everybody's having a go, agreeing or disagreeing with Aristotle's ideas on the physical world as you go through the Middle Ages. Interestingly enough, in 1277, there was a church condemnation. Yes, a church condemnation, which actually helped to push forward the progress of science. Not stopping it, progressing it. How did that happen? Well, the Archbishop of Paris condemned a number of theses being taught in the ideas being taught in the University of Paris at the time. And among some of these was those taught by people who followed the version of Aristotle, who said that the way that the world is absolutely necessary. This is the way it has to be. And God couldn't have done it any other way. Which was a bit kind of armchair kind of, I can work out the physical nature of the world from my armchair like a mathematical problem. I can sort of work it out. And people who were using Aristotle in that way were condemned because the condemnation by the Archbishop, not higher up by the Pope, but the Archbishop was very influential because he had oversight of the University of Paris, which was a key institution. But the fact those propositions were condemned, this idea of sort of almost you can work out the nature of the physical world as you'd sit in your armchair and work out a mathematical plan. No, says the Archbishop, because God could make the world differently, he can make a different world, it's in God's power and freedom, he didn't have to make this world at all. And what that continued to stimulate was experiment. So people say, well, okay, I can come up with a mathematical idea of something, science uses mathematics, but how did God make the bee? And how did God make the tree? I can't just sit here and work it out of this. There are various ways he might have done it. So I have to go out and do experiments with trees, and do experiments with bees, and do experiments with the earth and the minerals, and find out what is the nature of these things. I can't just sit in my armchair and say, oh, God must have followed this plan in doing it, because God's free to have made the world differently than he did. And maybe, you know, the nature of stone or something, when we understand it scientifically, it could look the same, but there could be different explanations of the same appearance. And so that gave a push to further experiment. Well, you know, okay, I've got a theory of why these rocks look like that, but now I need to do experiments. I need to find out if my theory is true, and chipping into them, dissolving bits of this rock in a fluid, or I mean, I've got to do experiments to find out how God did do the world, make the world physically. I can't just sit in my armchair and know it all beforehand, like a mathematical thing. And that gave a massive impetus to experiment. This was something I was saying. So as a contemporary, a Dominican, almost contemporary, Thomas Aquinas, a Dominican, Theodoric of Freiburg, who in the 1280s or 90s, did experiments on the nature of the rainbow, the primary rainbow that we see in the secondary, and he did these experiments and he came up with the explanation of the rainbow that we have today. And that's an example of experimental science in the medieval period. So this is one of the things, and of course the whole rationality of the universe and the fact that God creates a world, God is the primary cause of everything, but he makes a world of secondary causes. He really does cause a world in which my hand, you know, pushing the door, closes the door. Everything's not immediately done by God. God is the primary cause of everything, but there really are secondary causes. So the rabbit's nature to run away from a fox is really the rabbit running itself. God makes all these secondary causes, and it's for us to understand and try and find out the nature of the rabbit, the nature of this, the nature of that, the nature of the particles, physical particles, and find out all these secondary causes. But he makes this world out of wisdom, and it's an intelligible world. And this is something that science witnesses massively to the intelligibility of the world. I mentioned passing atheist philosophers of past period. One of them was One of them was Anthony Flew, who used to write a lot on atheism in the 1960s, atheist philosophy and philosophy of atheism. And Anthony Flew, actually the chap I was telling you about, Roy Barghese, he got in dialogue with Anthony Flew, I think in the 1990s, before Flew died, and Flew came to believe in God, came to believe in God because of the intelligibility of the universe, the design of the universe. Very often you find this, that these, I mean, even Bertrand Russell, he writes a book, Why I'm Not a Christian, in the 1920s. But there he has a footnote somewhere saying, well, there seems to be quite a lot of evidence from psychical research and things like that, that maybe there is a life after this life. And if more of this evidence was to accumulate, I would have to change my views and think there is a life after death. So, you know, there are people, you know, that they're so correlated, but at the edges you see them saying other things, and other things happen in their lives. The moral history. So the other thing that the new atheism attacked was the moral record of Christianity. Oh, look at all these terrible people, look at all these awful people in the past. Christians, well, you know, not only their failure, but Christianity itself is a religion, is a morally dangerous thing. You know, look at 9/11, that was the big thing. Now, again, whose religion are you talking about? First of all, we have to separate out these things. I'm not going to discuss Islam, because there are things I think about Islam that I wouldn't apply to Christianity, or I would apply to another religion, or Judaism. So, first of all, the response to the new atheist is, well, let's look at the religion I know best, that's one way of approaching it, and that's Christianity, and not just Christianity, but Catholicism. And this thing of the moral record, starting from the other end, look at the way that, you know, the anti-religious philosophies, I think I'm running ahead, that's on the next page, but the anti-religious philosophies of the last 200 years, you know, the philosophy of the Enlightenment, which is meant to enthrone reason as a goddess, and did in the churches in Paris when they were desecrated, the goddess of reason danced on the altar, some French lady. Where did reason get us? Into the bloodbaths of, in that sense, the bloodbaths of the French Revolution. Then communism, Nazism, these regimes that proclaimed the death of God, as John Paul II said, who lived through the awful traumas of Nazism and then the poor Poles, you know, straight out of the frying pan into the fire, and then the Second World War, getting out of Nazi domination into communist domination. He lived through all that. And of course, as he said from his own witness, when you talk about the death of God, you immediately imply the death of man. Human dignity disappears. This is what happens, and you treat human beings as cannon fodder. They're things to be disposed of. So the record of anti-religious movements is far, far more violent than anything, and brutal than anything. And the cruelty that they perform is in the name of their, it's not a failure in living out religion, it's part of their ideology. It's part of, you know, you just shoot the Tsar's children, you butcher the children of the bourgeoisie because you're on your way to make this wonderful world where everybody's going to be happy. Well, when you waded through miles of blood and sadistic murder, are you really going to end up as human beings who have this wonderful utopia where you all live happily and sweet and ever after? Well, no, I don't think so. I think I'm on to the next page now. But often these things are brought up, of course, rightly so. Oh, look at Catholicism, what about the moral record of things like the Crusades, the Inquisition, and so forth? Okay, well, we can look at those. There are things certainly not to be proud of, but we have to look at them. So it said here, the best apologetics is A, honestly acknowledge faults and sins of the past, and B, make use of the best up-to-date academic scholarship on a subject, written by religious and non-religious academics alike. So, you know, that's in the case of the Inquisition, the Crusades. We need to look at the good scholarship. That's not to exonerate bad things that happened, bad things were done. And in fact, if you look, you can look at the old Gavin Encyclopedia online, and it talks about when Pope Leo XIII opened the Vatican archives to scholars in the 1890s, and he was addressing the cardinals. This is the 1890s, and he said, we have to acknowledge the evils and sins committed in the past by the church. This was in the 1890s, even by those high up in the church. And that's not a new thing in Catholicism. One of the great texts of the medieval Catholicism is what? Is Dante's Divine Comedy. And in Dante's Divine Comedy, you know, hell is littered with popes and bishops. This isn't sort of, oh no, they were all, you know, we know that church historians knew how terrible some of these people were, how dreadful they were as wounds in the body of Christ. What a thing to be ashamed of. That wasn't something that was hidden from people. They knew it. I always think that's part of the heroism of John Fisher and Thomas More. These were, you know, in those days, 1500s, you didn't have the internet. Now, if some bishop does some bad thing in China, you can know it seconds later, if it gets revealed. Of course, ordinary people, even reading people, the news was slow to spread. But John Fisher and Thomas More were part of a European network of humanist Catholic scholars. They knew all about the awful lives of some of the Renaissance popes in their time. You know, their More's friend Erasmus was there in Chelsea, you know, writing about these bad popes who were there. And yet, More gave his life, and so did Fisher, for the truth of the chair of Peter as being the rock of the faith, despite knowing how terrible some of its occupants had just been in their lifetimes. Anyway, let's look at the big picture first before you look at individual things that you rightly should, like Inquisition and so forth. Our faith, we believe, is founded by the incarnate Son of God. We do not find many people, certainly not in movements like New Atheism, questioning the moral power of what we read in the Gospels of the life and teaching of Christ. That life and that teaching has inspired and informed numerous people in moral living, not only in our own culture or in our own religion, but many others. You know, people like Gandhi and others look to the figure of Christ, to this holiness, this wonderful teaching. You know, they admire, even they don't accept the faith of him as the Son of God. Indeed, what many people, new atheists include, take for granted as the basis of morality from which they judge what's morally bad comes precisely from this Christian heritage. It's on that basis, too, that we can acknowledge the sins and faults of those who came before us in the history of the church and in ourselves. So, you know, if you look at what their criticisms are, they're basing their criticisms on the Christian heritage. They're saying, oh, these awful people, well, why are they awful? Because they shouldn't do that. Well, why shouldn't they do that? Well, we all know you shouldn't. Why do you know them? Because that's your Christian heritage is telling you that. You're criticising on the basis. For example, you can have a totally different heritage. I mean, the neo-atheists are not like, you know, Friedrich Nietzsche. I mean, he at least had a totally different moral viewpoint from Christianity. He said, oh, Christianity and the ancient moral of the ancient world, the Greeks and Romans, was always about the masters, you know, knew they should despise and hate the slave class, and all this Christian nonsense about equality and mercy that comes in about from Christianity, and Christianity appeals to the slaves, and so Nietzsche proposes a totally different morality. He doesn't think. If you're a bourgeois pope and you execute a few people, it's not good on you, you know, that's my morality, you know, you're behaving like an old Roman senator. New atheists are like, not like that. They're taking the Christian moral view of saying this is sinful, that's bad. They're not, you know, Nietzsche presents a totally different morality of, Nietzsche thinks people like, Thomas Aquinas are all wrong, all this nonsense about equality, human beings aren't equal. Some are inferior and they should be treated like trash. But that's not what the new atheists are saying. They're saying, oh, no, look at these bad things that Christians did. Because they're using the Christian morality as the basis of their criticism of Christianity itself. So there are different systems of, even in different worldviews. Take Hinduism. you know, there's the Dalits, there's the Dalit class, who are the untouchables. Actually, many of them become Catholics in Dalit, who really, because of what they've done in a previous life, I mean, only deserve to clean dung off the streets, and you shouldn't let them go any higher in society. You know, when the Jesuits evangelized in Japan, in the 16th century, one of the things that the Japanese reacted against and why the missions were closed down violently was because this was a threat to their worldview. In the Japanese worldview, the idea of equality between people was totally unacceptable. No, the shogun were a different, like, it's like saying it's equality between pigeons and rats. That you're totally different. You know, the shogun are a different type of being than the peasants. They're not all, you know, this human equality. That's dangerous stuff. That destroys our society. So, there's a certain Christian worldview that everybody, again, however confused they are, tends to take for granted, but they're really living off their Christian heritage. Now, you can argue for that morality in terms of reason itself, a lot of it anyway, natural law, as we'll see there, but as I say, living out natural law and perfecting it, you need Christianity, you need the grace of the gospel to perfect natural law, and also even have the grace to live out the dictates of natural law. Otherwise, cultures inevitably slip away from natural law because of human sinfulness and the temptation to run away from what's difficult and demanding. So, the Christian morality, I'm not saying it's only Christian morality as revealed, but in fact, Christian morality is the basis of the morality that we live in the West, and even these people who no longer say they're Christians, they're accepting all the basic things of Christianity, and it's from those that they're attacking Christianity itself. They're saying it's... this is what I was saying before. Well, you know, if you want to attack the massive evil in history, then you can see far more evil in these modern anti-religious movements, the French Revolution, communist regimes, Nazi regimes, and these philosophies hold, actually, as part of them, the ends justifies the means. They're ready for genocide if it will help to get to the supposed bright new day for society, or our German folk, or whatever. You know, you can torture anybody, kill, torture children. It's justified because in the end, our people will come out triumphant. So those anti-Christian ideologies, certainly we can't say they're, you know, superior to Christian morality. When you leave Christianity out, you slide on the path to the demonic, as JP2 insists. And then further, you know, as our response to this point of new atheism, what greater moral heroes do we actually encounter over the last 2,000 years than the numerous women and men who are the canonized saints and blessings of the church? They set the standard, the truly high moral bar of human beings who are so morally good that beyond the norm in their charity, their kindness, and their love of other people. And they will say to you, oh, I just didn't do this out of my own bootstraps. I only did this through the power of the sacraments, through the power of Christ, that I'm weak, a sinner, that these wonderful saints. And I often think it's, with all, you know, good modern biographies and good documentaries on the lives of the saints, that the lives of the saints are the underused apologetic of the church. You know, that when we, it's meeting the holiness of people, and when you read these biographies, and, you know, good, proper biographies that are not legendary, that are carefully compiled in terms of the critical norms of the church, where the claims of miracles have to be carefully assessed and so forth. That's been going on some centuries. So there's so many, like St. John Vianney, the feast today, great book, Proco, I think, the classic, book on John Vianney, that's based on the actual documents for the canonization process, which have to be absolutely critical. The devil's advocate, said a miracle happens there, well, it could be counted. They have to pass the acid test, the claims of of miracles and of these holy things. But I mean, John Vianney, all the miracles that you read in the Gospels were happening, day and night to him. and his utter holiness and so forth. You know, those kind of people, again, are our response to this new atheism thing. Oh, you know, the moral Christianity is just morally bad for you. Well, I mean, what nonsense when you meet Mother Teresa or a John Vianney or something like this. Where are you coming from? We can also think of the moral history, for instance, of the end of slavery. That happens in Christianity. Christianity disappears, slavery disappears. That's a unique thing in world history too. Most of slavery is pretty general across world history till the coming of Christianity, then it disappears in the West gradually. And then when it rears its ugly head again, when the Portuguese start to make discoveries on the west coast of Africa, you know, of course, Christians being sinners attempted to plug into the existing Islamic and regional slave trade and make it far, far, far worse. The popes start condemning this. First of all, Eugenius IV in 1455, Pius VII, second in 1562, condemnations of Paul III in 1537, and on. Slavery, the slave trade is constantly condemned by the popes from the 15th century on. Of course, whether people take any notice of them, well, do people take any notice of Humani Vitae? You know, so, yeah. But there you go. And then, you know, and the place of women. Newman, interesting enough, I was surprised to find that in the Grammar of Dissent, Newman points to that as one of the good effects of Christianity, the elevation of the place of women in history. He noticed that. Of course, that's with the place of Our Lady and the dignity of women and so forth. That's there in Christianity. I think I'm skating across lots and lots of things. And finally, you can look at particular cases, acknowledging sin and failure and the need for moral progress. There's no question of that. But also looking at historical scholarship that helps look at the moral picture and see that it's not always as simple and simplistic as sometimes presented. I'm thinking of things like the Inquisition and the Crusades. Not everything that happened in those things can be, say, oh, that's great, morally bad things, moral things that happen morally that people progressed and realised they shouldn't have done. That's all to the case, but you have to see them in context. For example, in our own lifetimes, fundamentally, what's happened is we've had something similar to the Crusades. We've had battles with Islamic forces, in Afghanistan. That's no different from what was happening. Certainly, the First Crusade began because warlike Islam was overrunning Christian cities, and in fact, those parts of Christendom were already separated from Rome in the sad split with the East. But they made appeal to the Pope to try and help their cities, defend their women and children from Islamic onslaught. And the Pope, although they were separated already, that was an Orthodox man, the Pope made appeal to Christians to go and help them and protect them. There's no different from going out, sending American jets and things now to try and stop, jihad in attacking cities and stuff. So in a way, people almost reassess the Crusades because we're seeing it through our very recent lens. I'm saying, certainly the First Crusade arguably was a justified war of self-defense. It wasn't, what happened afterwards, the just war theory, wars can have a just cause and so forth, but then the way people do them, the sin and wars are not a good idea, the result of original sin, so even if a war is justified, lots of bad things start happening because people get tempted into all sorts of things. But, and things like that, and then there's the Inquisition again, long story about that, but we've got to finish. But suffice it to say, the Inquisition was not one thing, but various things, various movements. It was the Roman Inquisition, there was the Spanish Inquisition. And the Spanish Inquisition was often a political thing, as much to do with the aims of the monarchy in Spain as it was with the Catholic Church. So, for example, the Spanish Inquisition condemned the books of Cardinal Baronius, who was almost elected Pope. Cardinal Baronius was an early member of the community of St. Philip Neri in the 1600s. 1500s. Abronius was one of the great church historians, debating with, and Abronius was almost like the Pope. But the Spanish Inquisition in Spain put his books on the index and burnt them. A cardinal of the Holy Roman Church, high up, Pope, system Pope, with books burnt by the Spanish Inquisition. Why? Because in some of the historical books, the Spanish monarchy didn't like it, because it looked like he was saying things about the rights of the Spanish monarch to certain things where the Spanish monarch didn't like. So the eminent cardinal in Rome had his books burnt by the Spanish Inquisition. So it's a much more complex thing than we might think. That's just a little indication. And as Cardinal Ratzinger said, also the Monty Python joke, I was watching that sketch the other day, I love it, Monty. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition. In fact, everybody expected the Spanish Inquisition because they gave you a warning of 30 days that they were after you. And they won't stop you. You could just get up and leave and run away. So they said, we're coming in 30 days, you can scarper if you like, if you don't. So that was quite nice. Also, historians have argued that in the Spanish Inquisition implemented a proper legal procedure where before there had just been denunciations, like that typical thing, I don't like the lady next door, so I'm going to say she's a witch. And, burner, she's a witch, Frida next door says, we want to burn a witch, it's like Monty Python. But the Inquisition said, come on, let's look at the evidence, I'm sorry, this is, and also as Cardinal Ratzinger pointed out when he was gone, he said, the Inquisition was treating things like child abuse on clergy and attacks on women by clergy, clergy, and they were dealing with those. Those were the people that often prosecuted and sent to prison, so they weren't just... So, there were bad things that happened. We regret things that happened. There's no excusing certain things that happened. And we moved on from those things. But we have to see these things also more complicated historically than might be sometimes portrayed in a mixture of good and bad things. Anyway, we don't lose sight of the big picture of the life of grace of the church, the holiness of Christ, the holiness of totus Christus of the whole church, the saints. Where else do you find these saints like the saint we celebrate today, St. John Vianney, being human beings like that? If some movement, organization can produce a human being like that, what else have we got to say? But that is good. Okay. Right, well, thank you very much.